This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. In the studios of the Library of Congress, I'm Grace Cavalieri with Natalie Dykstra, who is the winner of the Best Book on Writing in the Arts, the Marfield Award, and that's granted by the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. Welcome, Natalie. Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
This is the only literary award for writing in the arts, and it's highly competitive. And all these books come in from publishers on film and dance and art. So you won. What is the title of this book and what is it about?
So the title of my book is Chasing Beauty, The Life of Isabella Stewart Gardner. And it's a cradle-to-grave biography of this extraordinary woman who is most known for her eponymous museum in Boston.
This may be the most consummate book I've ever read about a biographical figure because the detail, Natalie, the detail, I am still stunned by it. How many years in the making is this book?
So my first email of inquiry to the wonderful archivist, Shana McKenna, at the Gardner Museum was dated March 2014. So was dated March 2014.
Almost.
So that's 10 years.
More than 10.
Yeah, more than 10. So it was published last year in March. So it was 10 years from that first email until publication.
Is this working every day for 10 years? Either of the research or thinking or studying or writing?
Yes, in some way. I was also at the time a faculty member for one semester at a Michigan college, and then I was living with my husband outside of Boston from January through August. So for those months when I was in the Boston area, then it was really full time. And then I was able to secure a public scholars award from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mm-hmm. Which really made it possible for me to work full-time and then also retire early. So from 2020 until the publication, wow. I was working every single day.
She's also the author of Clover Adams, A Gilded and Heartbreaking Life, which was a finalist for the 2013 Massachusetts Book Award. But when did you fall in love with this idea, with your subject, and with this era of history? Has this been always with you, or just one day do you say, I'm just bitten by this idea?
So I have my PhD in American Studies, and I wrote on the long 19th century for my dissertation. And then my first book was, as you said, on Clover Adams, who was a Washingtonian married to the historian Henry Adams and descendant of the Adams presidents, and they lived on H Street. And so I had done a lot of work for that book on 19th century history, and I was also very interested in visual evidence as a kind of resource for biography. So a lot of biographies are about literary figures, not coincidentally, because their archive is filled with written sources. And so I was very interested in how to think about photography in the case of Clover, because she was such a gifted photographer in the years before Kodak. I was interested in how I might tell her story through the images that she made, to see her life through her camera lens and interpret those photographs in relation to the letters that survive.
I can see how that paved the way.
And that paves the way.
And your writing is pure silk. The details are unprecedented. I knew every necklace and every earring that Isabel Gardner wore. So give us the trajectory of the timeline in terms of dates.
Okay, so she was born in 1840 in New York. She was a New Yorker, the oldest of four children. Her father was David Stewart, and he traded in Irish and Scottish linen. And he was in a, you know, he was rising in the social class. So he ended up making quite a bit of money, but he didn't start that way, right? And so, although he did inherit some real estate from his mother. So
she was moneyed.
She was, but it was she married into a much wealthier family.
Jack Gardner.
Jack Lowell Gardner. So he was from these old Boston families. And his mother was Catherine Peabody Gardner.
Of course.
Of course, from the Peabodys of Salem. And so her parents were very happy about this marriage, this young marriage, because she was marrying into such an established Boston family.
Well, here's what I was impressed with. You are looking at a scope of history. You're looking at a span of history. You're looking at characters with psychological interactions.
Yeah.
You're looking at the world transitions at that time and the art objects. And I say, where does a person begin? You know, this is, there are so many strands here.
Yes.
That to enter the process is what interests me. What did you do first?
So what you first do is read around the edges of your subject. So I looked at a lot of memoirs that were published in the early 20th century about life in Boston in the 19th century and anyone's memories of her.
Not only hers.
That's exactly right. So I first started with some secondary sources. And then very early on, I was working in the archive at the museum. And then I got very scared because of the scale of the projects. For many aspects of the scale, it's her long life. She was born in 1840 and she dies in 1924. So she lives to see modernism. Right? And all those technological changes of the Gilded Age, right? And how the country changes as well. We're not a global power in 1840 when she's born, and we are by the...
Then there's the Great War.
And the Great War.
Yeah.
And so, two Great Wars, Civil War and the World War I. And so, you know, she saw so much
of
that
history.
Well,
how did you overcome your feelings? Because what did you have to overcome to go on and say, I can do this?
I felt such an enormous sense of responsibility.
Because no one's ever done this before.
At this length. So the museum has published a companion biography, and it's a very good one, to their the guide to the collection. And that was hugely beneficial to me. It came out just before mine, but it was very well researched. And so But there hasn't been a long biography of her in a very long time.
So the book is called Chasing Beauty. How did you come up with that title?
So I came up with the title. There's always a moment in publication where you sell a book with a title, and sometimes you get lucky and it's the one you keep, and sometimes it has to change. And mine needed to change, and I loved having a two-word biography that had a verb in it because she was so much about movement.
That's exactly what I feel. I knew exactly why you did this.
Yes, she was so much about being, she loved speed, she loved to move, she was an athlete, she was a dancer, she was kind of always on the move. And so I wanted something that conveyed her that energy, but I also wanted something that was a tiny bit melancholy. Right? And I wanted a word from the 19th century that she used a lot. So I looked both in her letters, and I knew I was attracted to beauty because she was talking to so many of her friends and to Jack about beauty.
Beauty's natural to me. Chasing is the brilliant word.
It conveys something of her in combination with the Anders Zorn painting on the cover of the book.
Which we will talk about.
Yes, which we will talk about.
Well, we're going to hear a little bit of this book. This is a Marfield Award celebrating its 19th year from the Arts Club of Washington, D.C. Natalie Dykstra is our author, and it is Chasing Beauty. Let's hear a bit.
Yes. So this is from a prologue on Notes on a Museum. In her own time and now, Isabella Stewart Gardner seems like a bright sun. We can look around her, but not directly at her. She radiates, but confuses. A relative remembered how she filled the air. Another thought her charisma was like dynamite. She carried herself with noted sureness, with a gliding walk, like a proud ship in full sail. Young people particularly liked to be with her because of how, quote, she annihilated the thought and possibility of failure. She had a wonderful wit. Morris Carter, her friend, the first director of the museum, and later her first biographer, recalled in his private notes, "I said I wished I could find out what was the first thing she did that startled Boston. I said I used to use the word startle to avoid the more terrible word scandalized." She looked as roguish as possible and said that she never did anything of the kind, that she always led a very quiet and uneventful life. She had had many advantages. The eldest daughter of a wealthy New York family, she was educated at a Paris finishing school, followed by an early and envied marriage into a prominent gardener family of Boston. But all this did not protect her from the terrible pain of losing her only child. A friend noted her tendency to be self-protective, remarking that she rarely expressed her feelings directly. She was fiercely loyal. Yet she had a reputation for being an attention-seeking busybody with money enough to boss most everyone around. Isabella surely relished having all eyes on her. Early on, she carefully collected reports of her to-ings and fro-ings in society, knowing that mentions in the newspaper need not be positive to be good. She was often portrayed as imperious and eccentric. This stereotype recast her intense drive, her fearlessness, and her entrepreneurial skills as something far less potent and disruptive, easier to mock and set aside. She had a method to her work, which she explained in an undated letter. "I am obliged to correct my steps," she wrote. "That is, to do only certain things and not to add outside ones. I have a great deal of constant and necessary work to do that I can accomplish only in that way." No one, except maybe her husband Jack Gardner, would have suspected she could accomplish all that she did.
Natalie Dykstra, what we like is that you start with a psychological reason for her drive. Mm-hmm. And we get to know what's exactly motivating her every minute. And it's arrogance, pride, beauty.
Fear, sometimes.
She was human.
Yes.
You made her human.
Oh.
But she was searching for knowledge and beauty. You wrote those lines.
Yes.
Searching for knowledge and beauty. But our billionaires today are not. When you think of the people that were moneyed in those days, in the 1800s, yep, early 19, well, they were using their money, yes, for their own private pleasures. They lived well. But they really were seeking some aesthetic that was beyond, above themselves. Can you think of billionaires today who are doing that?
I mean, there are so many generous philanthropists in our country.
Really?
Yes.
Who are seeking knowledge and beauty?
Well, who's
not AI development?
Who support the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, for instance,
yeah,
who support the Museum of Fine Arts, who support all these extraordinary institutions in Boston and New York and all across the country. But I will say this, that the generation in the 19th century, the ones that I read about the most and know the most about, felt this deep obligation to the country, because they felt so grateful for everything that it had given them. And they were also closer to the Revolutionary War generation, right? So Boston is filled with these extraordinary institutions, many of which were founded, funded by descendants of Revolutionary War.
Very interesting.
Generals.
Very interesting.
And, right? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And then, of course, a huge patriotic fervor after the Civil War. This is what we fought for, right? And we need to elevate Americans, and we need to compete with other world. If we are to be a world power, like Europeans and other countries in the world, we have to have great...
An aesthetic.
Yes, great cultural institutions.
That is so informative.
There was such fear about what was called belatedness, that Americans knew how to make money. They were entrepreneurial. They knew how to... there was a lot of know-how, but they weren't finely educated.
That is so fine.
So they couldn't compete with Europe. The art of Europe and elsewhere.
I love that.
Right?
You have made it very clear.
We were a young country, and there was a lot of conversation about how young we were. And
that's the bedrock of this piece, of this book, in a way.
You know, she was very influenced by those earlier founders in Boston of these extraordinary institutions. And she wanted to give to the city and citizens of Boston who wouldn't have the means to go to Europe that experience of a bigger world. Because, you know why, Grace? Because it saved her life.
It was her life force.
It was, and it saved her own life after the loss of her only child.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So there's so many...
So her life got bigger as a result of all her travels and her eye, her amazing taste, her unending curiosity that expanded her life. And that is what she wanted to offer.
But the hydraulic was the money.
But the hydraulic was the money, absolutely. And she was no saint.
We're going to hear about that.
This
is Chasing Beauty, the Marfield Award winner, the 19th year for this award. Let us hear another reading.
All right.
Everyone needs to get this book because it's a page turner.
Thank you so much. So I'm going to read about the making of the painting that's on the cover of the book, of the portrait. And this is from a chapter called The Age of Mrs. Jack, which is a phrase in a notebook that Henry James kept.
Her good friend.
Her very good friend.
She hung out with the big ones, didn't she?
She did. And we can talk about her relationship with Henry James, of course, but this phrase, Age of Mrs. Jack, is he was anxious about how many Americans were starting to come over to Europe and sort of crowd its streets. And so he was saying, but this is the age of Mrs. Jack. That's the context of that quote. And so this is the chapter, Age of Mrs. Jack, 1894 to 1895. So she was born in 1840, so she's about 54 years old when this scene takes place. And it's the every even year, she and Jack would travel to Europe, often spending weeks either at the beginning of their trip, at the end, in Venice. This is the one year that they stayed in Venice in September 1895. So I just want to get that so the listeners can visualize that or imagine that. And one more backstory. Anders Zorn was a wonderful Swedish painter that she was very supportive of and really helped his career in America. And they're staying at, the scene takes place at the Palazzo Barbaro, which is on the Grand Canal, which is where they often stayed when they were in Venice. Anders and Emmer Zorn arrived in early October from Verona. The foursome, that would be Isabella, Jack, and the Zorns, went everywhere together, to the Lido, to Murano to watch the glassmakers, to the lush Venice public gardens. When not touring the city, Zorn spent the afternoons painting. He had made an etching of Isabella the year before, which had been a failure, or maybe a little too accurate. He conveyed her hauteur and something of her awkward smile, but he'd not been able to express something deeper about her, how he knew her in these years, alive, in the moment, responding so freshly to everything and everyone. And then, on the evening of October 21, Zorn saw the scene he wanted. She had stepped onto the Barbaro's large balconies that looked out on the great expanse of the Grand Canal. Musicians were playing in boats while the fireworks lit up the sky, making the water shimmer. Isabella urged her guests to, quote, "come out, all of you. This is too beautiful to miss." As she was stepping back inside, pushing against the panes of glass in the French doors, her arms opened wide, Zorn cried out to her, "Stay just as you are. That is the way I want to paint you." He began working that night, and by the next day, he had finished the picture of Mrs. G in the window, as Jack Gardner noted in his diary. Whereas John Singer Sargent's 1888 portrait of Isabella had the rather static quality of a Byzantine icon, Zorn caught Isabella in movement, as if on a stage. Her pose is dancer-like. She is a performer in front of her adoring audience. Her long, shapely arms are thrown wide, her heart available, the ends of her long fingers placed on the windows of the French doors. Her gown, set off by its background of fireworks and lit water, is like the one that had won praise in the Boston papers the summer before. It was again a simple, elegant confection with an airy, diaphanous effect that was characteristic of the peculiar refinement of Isabella's taste. Her long rope of pearls hang almost to her knees with an enormous ruby at the bottom. A bouquet of red flowers is visible at her feet as fireworks boom in the painting's background. She completely owns the space. The painting was later criticized as too much of a draft, too impressionistic, as was current in French painting, but the New York Times reported that the portrait's likeness was excellent. Isabella loved the painting. A few weeks later, she described to a friend, "The portrait of me is astounding, a night scene painted at night. I am on the balcony, stepping down into the salone, pushing both sides of the window back with my arms raised up and spread wide, exactly like me." It captured her energy, her fearlessness, her sense of freedom. Zorn would remember in his memoirs that he'd caught her personality, which he described as grandly majestic, more than most. Maybe this was the age of Mrs. Jack after all, if not in the way Henry James had quite imagined it.
Was he the one that said her face was like a lemon?
That was John Singer Sargent.
Oh, dear. But the reason I remember that is because she overcame that. She found a way to become beautiful.
Yes.
She wasn't naturally beautiful.
Yes.
But she had the way of making clothing a statement.
Yes. And be moved so beautifully, like a dancer. She was athletic.
Yes, yes.
Right? Fastest runner in her school. Right. Loved gymnastics. She had a beautiful figure
yes.
that she kept her whole life. She was very proud of her figure. And it was that self-possession that she came into as she aged.
Well, she had it in the beginning, because I think her clothing was almost a defense mechanism against mm-hmm. the animosity she received when she first entered the Society of Boston.
Yes.
And they did not like her for reasons of either arrogance or unconventionality.
Or from coming from elsewhere. Right? There were other New Yorkers who had come from elsewhere and married into Boston, a Boston family, and who she became. Julia Ward Howe is someone 20 years her senior who had had similar experiences
but
in
she
Boston
used
society.
Clothes to yeah. say, "I am superior." Now, was this seen?
Or to assert a kind of cultural authority. She used fashion because it was available.
But isn't
to
that
her.
Why people use fashion?
Sure.
I just have one more
yes.
salacious question.
Yeah.
Is this scene before or after her affair with the younger man?
Yes, this scene is after.
Because their husband, it repaired their marriage. Do you believe he forgave her for that?
So this is a complicated story. She had what I call a romantic friendship. It was an emotional entanglement. As I said last night at the public lecture, there's always a door a biographer can't enter, and often it's the bedroom door. There's only so much I can know about her intimate life, and that's the case now, but it's she would never have left records of that.
I see.
Right?
I see.
Right? She was a private person. She burned
okay.
her parts of her correspondence.
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's always, unless I have a source for what I'm claiming on the page,
You say just enough.
Just enough that you can imagine how she was vulnerable to someone like, his name was Frank Crawford, yes. F. Merriam Crawford. He was a novelist who outsold Henry James, much to Henry James's frustration. and he was 16 years her junior, impossibly handsome, spoke fluent Italian. They read Dante together. It was all, he was staying.
Who could blame her?
Yes. There was a lot of, he would come and talk business with Jack Gardner, and then he would read Dante, they would read Dante together. And then they had a kind of unaccountably, they had, or hard to parse out, they had 3 weeks on the North Shore where it seemed as if they were in the same house at the same time. And Jack was in town in Boston. And so I, from all the different sources that I gathered, you know, I came to understand this as a kind of midlife reaching to that younger generation, both for her own youth.
Oh, yes.
But also the mementos she kept from that relationship. She kept his novels, she kept his letters, but and poems that he wrote her. But she also kept locks of his baby hair and baby pictures. And that's what a mother keeps.
That's very
keeps.
Telling. Yes, that's more
not
a
what a lover. That's not what a lover keeps. That's what
a nurturer what a,
that's
keeps.
A, yeah.
I can understand that now.
Yeah, so that's...
That's enlightening. That piece of it.
Yeah,
says that, a lot.
When I discovered that, or yeah. when I found that in the archives at the museum, and the museum has it right there in the gallery cases. They have about 16 cases, gallery cases they call them in the museum itself that she had put together, collecting all her letters and all the mementos of all these different friendships and in the Crawford
Tell everyone
case.
Where the museum is.
So the museum is on the Fenway in Boston, right near the ballpark, and that was land that was filled in that had been marshland around the city.
Was that her home?
And that was, it was her home at the end of her life. She had a fourth floor apartment on the Fenway. And at the time, she was one of the only institutions there because the museum opened in 1903. So Jack Gardner dies in 1898. They marry in 1860. Jack Gardner dies in 1898. And she immediately, they had been talking about how are they going to protect this extraordinary art collection that they had in their homes at 152 Beacon, and then they had a country estate in Brookline called Green Hill. And of course, there was fear of fire. She had this dream of having a museum. She said, after being at the Poldi Pizzoli when she was 15, traveling there as a child, she turned to her friend and said, if ever I have the means, I want a beautiful house to fill it with beautiful things.
Well,
and so she had this dream of youth. That's why I have that phrase.
Go into a museum and we see the paintings there, but we never realized that they were brought by someone who loved them and found them and paid for them. And this is what the realization we get from this book. I would like to hear about the Vermeer.
You want me to talk about the Vermeer?
Can you read a bit of that?
Yes. Do you want me to read that? Okay. And we can come back to the fashion if you'd
like. Well, actually, we know she was hot, so we can go on. The Vermeer fascinates me because now we know how this actually happens. The auction.
Yeah, the auction. Let me read that. It won't take long.
It's page 200.
Yep.
You're so meticulous. I knew you were a scholar. What a burden to be a scholar.
Oh, no. What a privilege. It's extraordinarily, I mean, I get to stay in school my whole life. You know, I love school as a kid, and I found a way to be in school
the rest
of my
life. Well, this is a very playful book. It doesn't seem, there's not a lot of blood on it. I mean, it looks like you enjoyed writing it.
I mean, I was inspired by her, for sure.
For clearly.
Moved by it. And, you know, once after I stopped being so intimidated by her as well, she's a fearsome character. And also there's an institution with her name on it, and I wanted to be extraordinarily respectful. And they've been so generous and gracious.
And you had to finish it.
And yeah, so, I mean, there was just, I just felt an enormous responsibility. But I came to...
You can't do this without loving it.
Yeah, no, I did.
You can't do it without loving it.
I mean, because
that's the energy.
Yes, that is. And I felt like it was such a beautiful story. I knew that if I could just get out of the way and if I could just write every single day, that I knew that this line of her story, this early promise as a teenager. She was so loved. She had friends. Her friends in Paris said she had a capacity for jollification.
Whoa. That's
made up
quite a capacity.
Wonderful word. And then she has this great tragedy of losing Jackie.
Yeah.
They're her only child, and they had had a stillborn baby early in their marriage. Then she's pregnant one more time, and she loses that pregnancy, and the doctor says, you cannot have more children. And so she's 26.
She turns all that passion.
And what to do, right? Yeah. She can't go to Harvard, which is, she can see everyone else going to.
Women weren't allowed.
Right, exactly. Radcliffe hadn't been started. And so, you know, she had to remake her life. And there's this long quiet in her life and in the archive. Right, there's not a lot of materials in the archive of that era after losing Jackie, and then you can see how she starts to grow. Right,
she brought her to life,
and she comes. She sort of steps into her life in this new way, and it becomes, you know, her capacity to respond and her capacity to be moved by beauty, by what she found beautiful, saved her.
That is why I want to talk about the auction.
Okay, so let me talk about that.
Just a little bit, because it is very interesting.
Yes. So her father dies in 1891, David Stewart, and leaves her $2.75 million as in his estate. That is then the money that she starts to use to collect at a pace. And so this was kind of a pivotal purchase that she makes in December 1892. This is a pivotal choice that she makes in December of 1892. And this is in a chapter called The Concert. On Monday, December 5, 1892, Belle and Jack left their rooms at Hotel Westminster for a leisurely lunch at the nearby Café de Paris. They're in Paris, obviously. From there, they traveled by carriage to the premier auction house in all of France, the Hôtel de Rho, a crowded neighborhood of busy shops. Up for sale that day was an important, well-known collection of Dutch art. The Durow had been established in 1852 and was housed in a broken-down building of cream-colored stone, which had been sullied and defaced by the smoke and storms of urban life. The rooms were bustling, crowded with people from every social rank. Belle had bought a pair of elegant 18th-century silver goblets at the Durow the previous May, but the December auction would be on a wholly different scale. The collector and French critic, Tor Berger, had done more than anyone to revive the reputation of the 17th century Delft painter Johannes Vermeer, who had fallen out of favor earlier in the century. 59 paintings, the core of the collection, were now on view. Isabella would have seen Rembrandt's Steens and the exquisite Goldfinch by Rembrandt's students Carol Fabritus, the painting Tor Berger most liked to gaze upon at the end of his day. The auction catalog listed 5 works by Vermeer. Belle chose a luminescent painting measuring just 25 by 28 inches, aptly titled The Concert. It depicted a scene both familiar and dear to her heart, a musical performance in a private home. Isabella arranged with her regular Paris agent a scheme whereby she, a woman, could participate in the Durow auction discreetly. That day, she sat directly outside the sales room in a spot where he could see her. To signal interest in an object, she was to hold her white handkerchief over her mouth, but pull it away when she wanted out of the bid. The bidding was brisk. There was a lot to sell that day. Did her heart race a little as the price went up and up? Did she have a limit in mind, one she didn't want to exceed? She got her painting for 29,000 francs, $6,000, outmaneuvering far more experienced bidders. The small goldfinch sold for 55,000 francs. By this point in her life, Isabella had amassed a sizable collection of many kinds of beautiful objects, placing them with care in her homes. Thomas Russell Sullivan, playwright of Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, remembered in a journal entry dated February 6, 1891, lunched with Mrs. J.L. Gardner in her boudoir. It is filled with rare and beautiful things from every clime. Above the wainscot is a frieze of portrait heads, early Italian, 30 in all. A Dutch landscape, all gold and red and brown, is let into the wall over the fireplace. The hangings are priceless, Chinese and Indian, from imperial looms. She was already skilled in casting a spell with her surroundings, creating moods and feelings and experiences. During their visit, Isabella gestured to Sullivan, saying, "Everything here is a remembrance. The seeing, purchasing, having, arranging, and admiring, all of it was filled with memories of chasing beauty."
Well, above that paragraph, you say that she had a strand of neck of pearls, another strand that cost $70,000. That was above the, right above the Vermeer that cost $5,000.
Yes.
And I could not get over that. I mean, $70,000 for another strand of pearls, which she had several.
These were the best pearls in all of France.
But a Vermeer was only $6,000.
Yeah, yeah.
And now it would be how many millions?
But pearls were the most expensive jewel of any jewel in the 19th century because, on average, it was 1,000 dives to the bottom of the ocean to get one pearl.
But still a Vermeer for 6,000.
Yeah, but Vermeer's reputation had fallen away. And so she had the eye. She had the eye. And let me read just the end of that. There's one more paragraph because it kind of puts together the Vermeer purchase with her own sense of being a collector. Her many discussions with John Singer Sargent and James McNeil Whistler over dinner and in the painter's Paris and London studios, her tutorials with Charles Eliot Norton, her book collecting and travels, her long hours at the Louvre and the Prado and London's National Gallery, and her conversations with Henry James, all these had prepared her for this moment, to trust her eye, to be confident in her taste, to buy the object or painting she wanted. Object after object, arranged in a room, like word after word on a page, would speak what she could not or did not choose to say aloud.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
You're right? I got very interested to loop back to your first question. How did I get interested in this story? I was very intrigued with the question, can objects be eloquent like words or eloquent?
They are in poetry. I teach my students, use objects. Objects have vibrations.
Yeah.
Use objects.
Yes.
Yes, this is full of objects. That's why it's so imagistic, this book.
Yeah.
Now, the final talk I want to have, just quickly, the anecdote I would like from you is the fabulous one about Reims glass.
Yes.
So, first of all, just set us up at the time in history where that glass existed.
So there's a chapter called Blood and Thunder, and it's in World War One. It's the World War One chapter. And so this is 1914. So the war started in Europe. And
it's on page 371.
371.
Which you told me ahead of time.
Yes, I did.
And
so
I just think it's one of the stories that is just unforgettable.
Can I read it? It's going to be... So this is in this chapter, Blood and Thunder, 1915 to 1918. Bright colors catch the eye first, blazing reds, grassy yellows and greens, sharp blues. The rectangular panel made up of 105 pieces of gleaming glass is set in a dark wood frame placed against an exterior wall of clear glass. A garden is in view beyond. The panel, located in the Chinese loggia of the museum's first floor, is not very large, though it seems bigger when the sun pours in from the east, spreading rays of intense color over the stone floor. A close look reveals faces of two pieces of glass. In the first fragment on the lower right, one eye peers back like that of a cyclops. The second, larger face is above the first, more in the center and in three-quarter profile. Its half-quizzical expression, eyes looking up, seems to say, "What's this? Where did I come from?" The glass pieces came from the windows of the 13th century cathedral at Rennes, located northeast of Paris, under whose soaring choir France crowned her medieval kings. The catastrophic assault on the city came in September 1914 as Germans bombarded the edifice in successive raids, which set the ancient oak-timbered roof on fire. The lead in the windows dripped to the floor, igniting many of the interior furnishings. Soldiers picked up shards of stained glass scattered throughout the city to set into rings for their sweethearts. The cathedral became iconic as a martyr of stone, and photographs of the first and worst bombings in 1914 were reproduced on postcards and in newspapers around the world. In 1918, when it seemed likely that the city and its cathedral would be completely destroyed, Chester A. Howell, an ambulance driver from Dorchester, Massachusetts, gathered and boxed up 100-plus pieces of scattered cathedral glass. He sent them to Henry Sleeper, instructing him to give the collection to Isabella in recognition for her help to the American Field Service, which was an ambulance service. The panel does not form a portrait or a landscape. It is modernist in sensibility, focusing on shape and color as things in themselves. The artisans who composed it remain anonymous. How to value something created from such a mishmash of materials, centuries, and makers? A mere patch of color, an early museum curator called it. And yet, like everything in Isabella's museum, it is more. Pieces from the far past memorialize the less distant past, one era reaching to another. Isabella Stewart Gardner's life was split into before and after with the loss of her only child. Her grief consumed her. She hid away. She floundered. Slowly, over a long time, she came back to life. The panel made from the cathedral glass memorializes the tragedy of the Great War, but it is eloquent too of Fenway Court with its assemblage of artistic styles and periods, and the woman behind its creation. Isabella, like the small, inquiring face near the panel's center, looked up. In the blasted aftermath of loss, she put bits and pieces of beauty together into something new. Life is filled with far too much destruction and loss, and yet it can shine with color and light.
Oh.
She knew both enduring truths.
That is the voice of Natalie Dykstra. And it is the award-winning book, Chasing Beauty. The program is The Poet and the Poem, and it is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Snippet Fund, the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family, friends of the program, Natalie Canivore and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Mike Turpin's our engineer. I'm Grace Cavalieri.